As we begin this session, I think this fourth stanza sums up a lot of what we have covered and will cover in this particular topic of God and government. Crown Him the Lord of years, the potentate of time, creator of the rolling spheres, ineffably sublime. God is indeed the potentate of time. He is the one who orders and organizes all aspects of time. And He uses it in such a way to form where He wants His creation to go. We have a powerful, loving, merciful, and just God who uses His power to shape and mold the sin-filled world that we live in today. As we start this particular lesson, let me make sure the mic is on. It is. I want to just give a little bit of review from the last time. If you remember, we had talked about the issues of the references used by the men, our founding fathers, in the creation of the Declaration of Independence, and also the Constitution. And the Constitution was framed with many references to biblical principles. And I want to just go back and review some of those things as I was contemplating these, even on the ride in this morning. I had forgotten that this particular quote was in my notes last time, and I wanted to just bring it forth. I was reading it to Ruth on the way in, and it's a powerful quote. It says, "A leader's understanding and acceptance of accountability to God for his political behavior helps restrain him from compromise of principle. The founders understood that the principle of divine rewards and punishment applied not only to individual leaders, but also to the nation as its policies. The primary difference was that the rewards and punishments for nations occurred in this world rather than the next. As Samuel Adams explained, divine revelation assures us that righteousness exalteth a nation, Proverbs 14:34. Communities are dealt with in this world by the wise and just ruler of the universe. He rewards or punishes them according to their general character. George Mason, the father of the Bill of Rights, reminded the delegates at the Constitutional Convention, as nations cannot be rewarded or punished in the next world, so they must be in this. By an inevitable chain of causes and effects, Providence punishes national sins by national calamities." That's a powerful statement, isn't it? How many times have we seen these national calamities take place, not only in our nation, but in other nations as well? The more we depart from the Word of God and the principle of our rule, the more calamities will come upon us as a nation. That's a powerful reminder of why we should continue the effort to bring forth the gospel to lost men. The gospel will restrain the wickedness of men's hearts and political leaders. By doing that, we assure ourselves peace and tranquility and free from national calamities. 9/11 was not an accident. It was done in the providence and knowledge of God. The space shuttle explosion and re-entry disaster were both in the providence of God. These were not events that were outside of the knowledge of God at all. They were allowed to happen to bring our country to the position of mourning and to call upon God. What was it that God used in the life of Nineveh to bring forth national repentance? He used a preacher, one who brought forth the Word of God consistently. Now, it was a reluctant preacher, but nonetheless, it was a preacher who ultimately bowed the knee to God in his proclamation of the Word of God to a lost nation. Now, we can learn many things from something like this. We can learn that political leaders have a responsibility to lead their people in the ways of righteousness. Now, it was once said, and I think I mentioned this once before, but every law is somebody's morality. Every law is somebody's morality, which is exactly why we want godly men in office in order to lay down godly principles every time a law is contemplated. Now, there must be laws, and laws do one thing. They prohibit action, or they enforce certain actions. Now, generally speaking, we have laws that restrain us from doing certain things. And we're going to be talking about that principle in just a few minutes. But the idea is that laws keep us from the wickedness of our own hearts when applied biblically. There are some ungodly laws out there too, and they do exist. But let us not forget that we have a responsibility to put men of moral character into positions of authority. And that is the reason and the ultimate prod to my conscience to be involved in the political process. Now, not all men are cut out to be in the political process. And I'm not sure I'm cut out for it. But I'm going to use what gifts God has given me to try to be involved in a process that is flawed by nature because we're sinful men. But use a biblical principle in order to outline rules and regulations by which we live. And the rules and the regulations by which we live have to apply to all men, not just Christians. And they have to be applied and enforced fairly. And that's the other issue that doesn't happen well in the world of lost men, is the application of laws fairly against all men. And that is an area of corruption that has plagued our nation and every other nation since the inception of nation building itself. With that out of the way, let me first back up to where we were last time and talk about this idea of a roadmap to a better society. And I just wanted to also read this quote as we go forward. It was understood that our political acts cause God to respond either as an ally or as an adversary. Now, this is by a quote by George Washington. The widespread knowledge of this principle required that proposed laws and policies be judged with full cognizance of their spiritual implications. As Benjamin Franklin reminded the delegates at the Congressional Convention, and have we now forgotten that powerful friend, or do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? Without his concurring aid, we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. Now here is a quote by Benjamin Franklin being quoted by George Washington, that we need the aid of our sovereign and holy God. If we do not have his aid, we will, as a nation, be a byword, as many nations in the past have become bywords. Remember Rome. That's not an idle threat. That's a promise that God will have his justice, either in the nation itself or in individuals themselves. Let us not forget that we will be rewarded or punished based upon what we do as a nation and as individuals. And that itself is the restraining effect of religion upon government. That's the thing that keeps men in check, knowing that there is a future punishment or a future reward that will await them for their actions that they commit while leading people. There seems to be a particular pet peeve with God Almighty about leaders, people who lead people astray. He has a terse warning for preachers who preach false gospels and lead people astray. Preachers and teachers are more accountable to God. They have to give an account to the sheep for the sheep that they oversaw, that God made them the under-shepherd of. They must give an account. While it's no less true of political leaders who promote bad policy and policy that does not promote the good of the people, saved or unsaved. So we have to remember that as we move forward in this study. But over the overarching principle of all of this is that God will be the rewarder or punisher of evil men. Now, with that said, we must give some consideration to the idea of what makes a better society. The foundation the fathers have laid are crumbling. We've seen that throughout the years, even in our own lifetimes, we've seen that. There has been an abrogation of this separation of powers. Now, what does that mean? The abrogation of this separation of powers. Anybody care to qualify that? I know you know what it is, but let's bring it out in the air. What does it mean to abrogate? I'm sorry? Yeah, it means to give it up. And when I say separation of powers, what does that mean? When we think of our government in three broad strokes, what do we think of? What are the branches of government? Executive, judicial, and legislative, right? Those are the three branches of government. Now, why do you think those three branches of government were formed? What was the purpose or what was the reason of those three branches of government? Right, the whole idea of separation of powers. Have you heard that term before, separation of powers? We have separated the powers of our nation into three distinct groups. And why do you think the founders wanted that separation of power? Yeah, it was. They understood a basic principle. It's a principle of Calvinism. And what is that? What's the first principle of Calvinism? Total depravity. Our hearts are totally depraved. They're deprived too, but they're mostly depraved. We have depraved hearts. And as a depraved, fallen society that has fallen from a perfect image of God into a sinful image of God, in other words, sin has entered into the world through the sin of Adam, our federal head. He has corrupted our image-bearing capabilities of God, but we still are bearers of the image of God, but it's a marred image now, right? And that marred image now gives us that corruption that tends to all things that we do. That's what causes men to go to war. It's that depravity in our hearts. Now, when we think about this abrogation of the separation of powers that I just mentioned, with all that background that I just went through, what examples can you give, or can you think of, if you can think of any, of the abrogation of the separation of powers? Now, we have certain things that the legislative branch is to do, that the executive branch is to do, and the judiciary branch is to do. Now, let me just throw out, before we answer that question, let me just throw out this hypothetical. If the Supreme Court judges something to be unconstitutional, and the legislative branch does not see it to be unconstitutional, is the legislative branch bound by the Supreme Court decision? Let me show of hands. If you think that they are bound, raise your hand. If you do not think they're bound, raise your hand. Three people, I think, got that one there. They're not bound. They're separate powers. Andrew Jackson one time denied Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had ordered something to be done. I don't remember the exact count. I have to look it up. But he denied enforcing that order. The Supreme Court is under no authority to take over the executive branch, which is the commander-in-chief. It was a commander-in-chief decision to dispense the military. Andrew Jackson denied that order because he did not feel that the Supreme Court had the authority to declare that order to be carried out. And he was right. The Supreme Court does not order the military. The commander-in-chief does. Well, it's the same with all three powers. That Supreme Court judgment was ignored because there is a separation of powers that constitutionally allows the president not to obey that order in his good judgment. Now, the people have the right to vote the president out in the next election if they disagree with him. There's the check and balance right there. You see, but we've come to the idea that every Supreme Court order must be upheld. And it's a false notion. The Supreme Court order does not have to be enforced by the legislative or the judicial branch. It generally is, especially when the Supreme Court order does make sense, and generally it should be. But it's not guaranteed that it has to be. So we see this abrogation of the separation of powers. The executive branch has started to take on the responsibility of the legislative branch, and the legislative branch has not challenged the executive branch for that authority. So therefore, the executive branch has taken it over. It's happened just recently. Can anybody give an example of that? Bruce? Fast and Furious? Here's an example. I wasn't the one I was thinking of, but it is an example. The Fast and Furious, which was the issuance of guns to try to determine where these guns were going to in Mexico, and now the Attorney General has failed to respond to the contempt of Congress charge. How about the executive branch recently proclaiming against the legislative branch? It was passed into law and never challenged in the courts. The executive branch has usurped the authority to override the law that Congress has established. It was signed into law by the president, not this president, but a previous president. He's usurped the authority of the legislative branch. So there's this abrogation of the separation of powers. In order to maintain the legal authority that you have been granted, you must challenge it when it's been overruled by another branch. You understand what I'm saying? If your authority as a legislative branch has been usurped by another branch of government, it's your duty to uphold that authority that you've been given. You can't let it slide. Because if you let it slide, it's going to be abused more and more. And the whole purpose of separation of government was to keep the amassing of power separate. That's the whole idea. We have seen it destroying the cooperative relationship between church and state. Now, we've touched upon this in the past, so I don't want to dwell on it too long here. There used to be an ongoing relationship with the church and the state, not a state religion, but a recognition that the government should have the influence of religion within it. Right now, secularists are trying to keep the influence of the church completely outside the realm of the government, which isn't right either. There is that restraining effect that we talked about just a few minutes ago that keeps the government, righteous men, from doing wicked things, because they know that there's going to be a punishment for those who do evil things in the name of government. So that's the restraining effect of religion upon evil men and even good men in the spheres of government. Here's a big one that's really upset the balance of power, and it's not talked about too much, and I'm not going to get too much into it, but the federal government usurping the state's rights. And we've talked about that briefly in the past. And for more information on that, really it started with the 14th Amendment, with the issue of slavery after the Civil War. And what, in a nutshell, what happened was the 14th Amendment was used, in essence, to federalize the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights were really something that kept the government from doing certain things. And one of the things we're going to be talking about a lot in the next session, not this session, is the Bill of Rights. We're going to kind of lead up to it this session and then dump into it the next session. So I just want to bring that to your attention. Restricting public religious expressions has been another area that has crumbled in the previous years. How many times have we seen the townships and other religious expressions removed from public view? What's the case that comes to mind almost instantaneously around holidays? Yeah, the nativity scene. Nativity scenes have been banned from public display in public places. And that has been an ongoing effort. the issue out in, I think it's either New Mexico or Arizona, I forget which one it was, the display of a cross on public land and a memorial to the veterans of World War II. It was first covered so that it wouldn't be displayed. It wasn't taken down. And then somebody at night came in and used a torch and cut it down and removed it. This is an example of restricting public religious expressions. And one of the things we have to do is learn and understand the philosophy behind the founding documents. And that's incumbent upon every citizen to understand what the founding fathers really intended our nation to be. They never intended our nation to be devoid of religion or our government to be devoid of religion. They always knew that it was important for religion to play a part. And they also understood, and some of the framing fathers disagreed on this point, but they understood that every religion restrains sin in some way, regardless of Buddhism, Hinduism, even Islam. Now, people will disagree with that in light of today's extremists, but outside of the extreme positions of Islam, there is a restraining effect upon men. So religion had a particular cause in the formation of our Constitution and our Bill of Rights and our the amendments and the Declaration of Independence. Now, there are three steps that we can take to reverse this tide. First, identify and eliminate wrong information. One of the things that happens in this process is that information is rewritten. History is rewritten. Revisionists are commonly what they're called. And they rewrite the history books to express an event that did not happen the way they wrote it. That's revisionism. And it has to be challenged. When you see it, it should be challenged. If you see it if your children are in public schools or if it's in any context, not even in a school environment, when somebody quotes something and you know it's just not right, or you come back and later find out it's not right, it needs to be challenged. Because it's a misconception of history that didn't occur. So those types of things have to be identified and information has to be corrected. So that means you have to obtain the correct information and then you have to act on the proper information. So those are kind of the things that I didn't get a chance to get to last time. But we start on some new things this week, and it's this. It's four standards to evaluate proposed public ideas or policies. And here's the standards. What will the result of this proposed policy, in light of the principles of national accountability or the idea of rewards and punishments, be? What is it? And now, I'm going to leave this kind of open-ended, but I want to just throw these out there. And there's a quote that I've got marked out to read, but I'm going to bypass it. And the second point is this act consistent with our form of government? And what form of government do we have? And I think we talked about this before. We have a republic, right? We don't have a direct democracy. We have a republic, a representative government. And then I did raise this question before, and I want to reiterate it here. Why is a democracy a dangerous form of government? And I just want to hammer that home for a second. Remember, we talked about this before. Why is a democracy, a pure democracy, a dangerous form of government? Does anybody remember, Daniel? Yeah, it's really something that lends itself to mob rule or rule by majority. Now, republic is also a rule by majority, but it's a different type of thing, and I'll get into that in a second. But mob rule is something that is to be avoided. Mob rule, if I could use one event in history to characterize mob rule, it would be the French Revolution. Now, why would I say that? The French Revolution was nothing more than anarchy run in the form of a democracy. Now, this anarchy, if you were involved in this whole French Revolution thing, and you were a politician or somebody who opposed anybody in power, all you had to do was accuse that person, and they could be brought forth and their head chopped off. They called the guillotine the national razor in France. Because it started at the neck. Protestant guy. And there were many people who were beheaded on a simple accusation. Okay? So that's a demonstration of democracy gone wild. Now, and we asked this question before, and we didn't really explore it much, but why is a republic, relatively speaking, a more stable form of government, or for government? And some of the reasons that we talked about before, but can you give me any reasons? What do we have in our republic that has kept our nation safe these past years since our inception as a government? What can you give us examples of? And we've already mentioned one, the separation of powers, right? Our republic embraces the idea of the separations of power. So that helps to preserve us as a nation. What other things would help us as a republic? Any ideas? Some of our legal precepts that we use. Well, term limits are, those are generally state issues, states' rights issues, but term limits can be used to help in the republic. But I'm thinking more in terms of legal issues. As a republic, we have embraced the idea that men have the right to counsel. Even criminals have the right to counsel. And we're going to talk about that in a few minutes as well. The idea that the minority or the poor or the underprivileged have as many rights to the judicial system as the rich man does, or people of upper class. Now, in England, that was a real problem, because the lords of England were privileged men. They were privileged, and they were afforded rights that were not afforded to many of the poorer people in the nation. And the king had the ultimate right. The king could do pretty much anything he wanted until the Magna Carta and this term called habeas corpus came about, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. All right. So those are kind of the points that I wanted to get across on this. And I wanted to talk about this third point, is the information undergirding this policy verifiable in primary sources, or is it the product of revisionism? And one of the things that we're talking about here is this whole idea of the standards of evaluating government. And the fourth one is the person I'm about to vote for of sound moral and religious integrity? Now, if you know this guy, Paul Brown, I wouldn't vote for him if it was the last guy on earth, but you vote your conscience. If you're in Catskill, you'll vote for him, though. All right? But those are some standards that we should use as we're evaluating some of these things. Now, I want to jump to the Constitution, and actually, I should have printed this out for you to read, and maybe I'll make a copy of this next week. But Section 9 is of particular interest to me, and I'm going to read the whole section and then come back and comment on the pieces that I want. It's not too terribly long, so try to stick in there with me. This is the U.S. Constitution, Section 9. The migration or importation of such persons as may, as any of the states now existed shall think proper to admit, shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, not exceeding $10 for each person. So, not really what we're talking about. Now, here's something. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in the cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. We're going to get back to that one. No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. Another crucial area. No capitulation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census of enumeration herein before directed to be taken, which is our reason why we take census. And I'm going to have to read the other ones that have to do with taxes. But in the middle of this section, we have these two clauses. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, when in the case of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. Now, first of all, Does anybody know what the writ of habeas corpus is? Does anybody remember from their law, their study of social studies, what a writ is? A writ is nothing more than an order commanding somebody to appear before the court for the purpose of starting a proceeding. All right, that's a writ. In common day language, what would we call it today? A subpoena, or more commonly, a warrant, right? Or a subpoena. If it's issued by the bench, it's a warrant. If it's issued by the judiciary, subpoenas can be issued by a number of different people. But the same idea, subpoena or a warrant. Now, so this idea of being drawn before the bar of justice, this writ or this subpoena, has now been instituted in England, and now it's a legal term that has been employed to bring people before the court. Now this idea of a writ, was used many times in England, and a lot of times it was used simply to bring a person in to put them in jail, or to capture them and put them in jail. A lot of times it was for political reasons, or what the king thought was a threat to his realm. So this idea of bringing somebody before the court, having them appear before the bench, and then condemning them to prison before they had any due process or any idea of what was taking place, and had no right to call defense counsel. They didn't have any evidence against them. They couldn't call any witnesses. They were just summarily judged and put into prison. That was the use of the writ. Now, this idea of a writ of habeas corpus came into play. And the idea was a writ of habeas corpus was to bring somebody who's been in prison. They've been commanded to order them to come before the bench to face the bench. And the habeas corpus part is to free them for wrongful imprisonment. All right, this idea of writ of habeas corpus was to command somebody before the bench, that's the writ, and habeas corpus is the idea to free them because they've been wrongfully imprisoned. Now, we have in our Constitution, as I've just read, and I want to read it again just so you understand exactly what it says, the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in the case of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. So, in layman's terms, how would you recognize that term to mean? What would you recognize that phrase in the section of the Constitution to mean? So, the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless in the case of invasion or public safety. So, what would you mean? What would you think that means? Sorry, Katie, go ahead. So, the writ of habeas corpus cannot be suspended. All right, so that's what I'm shooting at. Any other ideas? Yeah, the idea here is the framers of the Constitution really wanted to make sure that nobody was illegally detained because of the power of an individual in government. Okay? They wanted a way by which people could be freed from wrongful imprisonment, and that right can't be suspended except in the cases of invasion of the nation or public safety in general, and it has to be a fairly heavy detrimental case that brings the safety of the public into harm. All right. So the framers wanted to make sure that they were not, the government did not have the power to unlawfully hold people against their will, and that's one of the things that was hotly contested. Now, I know this might seem a little dry, but it's one of our foundational rights as American citizens to understand that we cannot be held against our will without due cause. Okay? So if you're just brought before the bench and thrown into prison for speaking your mind politically, there's a habeas corpus doctrine that allows you to be freed without punishment. Okay? And we have some examples of that, and I will get to those in just a minute. Now, I want you to understand a little bit about this idea of bills of attainder. Now, that's also talked about here. It says, no bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. Now, does anybody understand what a bill of attainder is? Now, that's a constitutional term, and it's not a common term, and it's not used very much today because it's not invoked anymore. It hasn't been invoked since the late 1700s. But a bill of attainder was something of particular interest to the framers of our Constitution. A bill of attainder allowed the government to summarily judge and convict a person without due process. So, in other words, they could put out a bill of attainder that allowed you to be killed and all of your possessions be acquired by the state without any due process whatsoever. Now, that's a pretty heinous thing as we think about it today, right? It's something that we have not given much thought to, but it is something that happened on a regular basis. And I want to give an example of that here. Virginia's Declaration of Rights, for example, did not ban bills of attainder. In 1778, the Virginia Assembly adopted a bill of attainder and outlawry drafted by Jefferson at the instigation of Governor Patrick Henry against a reputed cutthroat Tory. Now, a Tory was a British sympathizer. All right? And Josiah Phillips and some 50 unnamed associates, by legislative enactment, that they were condemned for treason and murder on failure to surrender, were subject to being killed by anyone at the Virginia Ratifying Convention. Edmund Randolph, irked beyond endurance by Henry's assaults on the Constitution as dangerous to personal liberties, recalled with horror the shocking attainder. When Henry defended the attainder, John Marshall, who supported ratification without a Bill of Rights, declared, "Can we pretend to the enjoyment of political freedom or security when we are told that a man has been, by an act of assembly, struck out of existence without a trial by jury, without examination, without being confronted with his accusers and witnesses, without the benefits of the law of the land?" What was Marshall's argument here? What's his argument? He's arguing that as a legislative body, you are not allowed to condemn a man without being first confronted, indicted, and tried. You have that right. And that was the framing fathers' intent, is to give all men that right. That was not always a right of our land. There were cases that Josiah Phillips was indeed captured and killed under this bill of attainder, unjustly. Although he might have been a murderer, he never was confronted with his accusers. He was, in essence, killed on hearsay without proof of his deeds. And that was one of the things that the Federalists used later on to incorporate the Bill of Rights into the Constitution. And it was something of a reverse of political theory that allowed that to happen, and I'll get into that in a minute. Now, I want to talk again about this idea of ex facto. I know some of these terms are a little bit dry, but they're important before we get on to the next section. Ex post facto law. Now, ex post facto. What does post mean? After, right? Yeah, after. Ex post facto laws were sometimes created for the purpose of punishing somebody who didn't do anything illegal before the law was created, but the law was created to go back in time to make it illegal, thereby making him subject to the law. Now, it's kind of like a retroactive law. It wasn't illegal when you did it, but it's illegal now, and it's illegal when you did it because we made it so. Now, how would you like to live under those laws? I can declare that you, it's illegal for you to cook spaghetti on Wednesday nights. And if you do so, I'm going to come and arrest you. And not only that, but I'm going to arrest you and charge the accounts for every time you did it in the past. Now, obviously, cooking spaghetti wouldn't fall under the category generally, but the idea is that it's legal when you did it, but it's not legal after the ex facto law was enacted, and you're liable to suffer the consequences of the punishment of that law should you be counted to be included in that law. Okay? So it was an unfair dispensing of justice for political reasons. And this idea that you could make a law retroactive to throw somebody in jail was banned in our Constitution. And it was banned because it was practiced in the past in England. And there was some sense of it that had happened in the United States. Not very many, but there were cases of it. Okay? So this idea is we're trying to remember what it is that we're shooting for here. We're shooting for what type of righteousness must a nation hold to in order to make society fair for all men. And these are examples of righteousness or of evil that prevailed. All right, it was not a righteous thing to do. It was against the will of God to do these kinds of things. So we're laying down this foundation of why the Constitution has these certain phrases and terms in it, so that we can better understand what the Constitution and the Bill of Rights really does protect, and why it protects it. All right, and one of the things that we think about is some of these laws that have been passed for the purpose of protecting citizens against the powers. Undue abuse of powers by government officials. All right? And we read of this. I just want to share this with you. And on page 29 of this, this is called The Origins of the Bill of Rights. It's just a great little book. And it talks about some of this. Patrick Henry was... everybody remembers Patrick Henry. What was Patrick Henry's famous quote? I'm sure you all know it. Give me liberty or give me death. So he was a true patriot, although there are times when you can find examples when he wasn't exactly thinking correctly. All right, but that happens to all of us. Patrick Henry cleverly observed that the fair implication of the Federalist argument against the Bill of Rights was that the government could not do anything not forbidden by the Constitution. Because the provision of the writ of habeas corpus allowed its suspension when required for public safety, Henry reasoned, it results clearly that if it had not said so, they could suspend it at all cases whatsoever. You understand his argument? There was the whole idea is that the clause in Section 9 prohibited the government from doing it. Unless there's certain conditions existed. Well, what he's trying to argue is he was saying that because there were limits upon what the government can do, those limits occurred because they were codified in the Constitution, you see. And that was an argument that he used for other things later. But the idea is that there are limits placed upon government. And that's what we want. We want the government to be limited. When we say we want limited government, we want to limit the authority and the power that government can use to curtail your liberties. And that's what we need to do. And every time there's a law that curtails your liberty, is it a law that is righteous? Now, let me give you a quick example of a law that I think is righteous and nobody will argue against. You cannot text and drive at the same time. That's a righteous law. It puts you in danger, and it puts other people in danger. All right? I don't think anybody can argue that texting is good for driving. If you can do that, you got a career in law. All right? That's an example of a law that protects the safety of people. And it limits certain things that you can do while driving. And he goes on, he says here, Henry reasoned it as its results clearly that if it had not said so, they could suspend it in all cases whatsoever. It reverses the position of the friends of this Constitution, that everything is retained which is not given up. For instead of this, everything is given up which is not expressly reserved. You see the idea here? In his influential letters of a federal farmer, Richard Henry Lee observed that a clause of the Constitution prohibited Congress from granting titles of nobility. If the clause had been omitted, he wondered whether Congress would have the power to grant such titles, and he concluded that it would not under any provision of the Constitution. When a negative clause restrains Congress from doing what it had power to do, this clause then must have no meaning or imply that were it omitted, Congress would have the power in question. On the principle that Congress possesses the power not expressly reserved, Lee objected to leaving the rights of the people to the logical inferences, because Federalist principles led to the implication that all the rights not mentioned in the Constitution were intended to be relinquished. You see? If the Constitution doesn't say what the government can't do, then the government can do it and take that liberty away. That's why the government's limited in what it can do. When you don't limit the government, you allow it to do it. And that's a dangerous position when the government starts to cross that constitutional boundary. And that's what we see today. We see people in legislative positions that are crossing that boundary illegally. And it's causing havoc in our nation. They are usurping certain things that they have no right to usurp. And that is dangerous ground. And as a nation founded upon principles of restraint, the restraint of religion, and the idea that we're restraining government from doing certain things, we have a responsibility and a duty to speak out when we see somebody stepping across those restraints. And we're seeing it more and more in the federal government, and even in the state government. The state government has more authority, in my mind, to lay down those restraints than the federal government does. Because if you look at the state governments, some of these things are enumerated, and some of them are not, but they're enumerated in more detail than what the federal government is. The federal government has restraints placed upon it in broad terms that forbid it from doing certain things. And we allow the government to usurp our liberties when we don't contest them when they're stepped on. That's the importance of being involved in the political process. Now, it's not always easy to be involved in the political process. And the easiest thing that we can do is vote. And when we vote, we have to be sure that we're voting for people that will uphold principles that will not abridge our liberties. Now, we have to do that knowing that, first of all, we are citizens of the United States, but also that we're citizens of a higher kingdom as well. So when we do our duty, we have to be sure that we do our duty in the precepts of biblical principles, in the idea that what we're doing is we're doing it in biblical principles. We want to be participants in the governmental process, in the legislative process, in the electoral process, knowing that our vote has the opportunity to put somebody in office who has a clear view of where the boundaries of government should be. And that's one of our duties. Now, we touched upon this earlier, and I want to bring it back. The Bill of Rights were instruments used to keep the majority from infringing upon the rights of the minority. And here again we see an example of that. It says, the great objective he had, now we're talking about one of the British rulers, and I'll get back to it in just a second. The great objective he had in mind, Madison declared, was to limit the powers of government, thus preventing legislative as well as executive abuse, and above all, preventing abuse of power by the body of the people operating by the majority against the minority. Mere paper barriers might fail, but they raised a standard that might educate the majority against acts to which they might be inclined. So he was referring to the Bill of Rights. He said, now the Bill of Rights might be just a paper barrier to people who want to commit these oversteps of government, but at least they're on paper and they remind them that there are limits that are placed upon them. Now, when they're codified, and they are in the Constitution, they now can be challenged. Those who would abuse the powers that they have can now be challenged based upon constitutional rights. And I just want to stop there and just mention this for a second. When people tell you that the Constitution is a living, breathing document, that's liberal speak for this. The Founding Fathers really never intended this to happen because they could never have foreseen what our society is going to look like today. Therefore, we need to make sure that the Constitution is a living, breathing document keeping up with the modern times. When that wasn't the foundation of the Constitution to begin with, the foundation of the Constitution and the Declaration were simply this. They understood the depravity of man. That is the thing that keeps men in this state of always wanting more and more and more, this depravity. And the framers understood that depravity very well. Many of the framers were Calvinists in their theological thinking. They weren't Arminians. They were Calvinists because they understood the depravity of man. They didn't think man was basically good and he was going to do the right thing in the right circumstances. They understood that man was basically evil and he would do the wrong thing at the most inappropriate time. That's how they viewed man. And that's why they limited government. All right? And we have, sadly, again, fallen short of the much-needed time I wanted to have to go through this. But I hope it wasn't too boring. And let's close in prayer, and we will continue again next time.